Welcome to episode 14 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Our guest today is Christian Curtis, who talks with us about Native experiences of COVID. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
You know, I'm not sure if our listeners know this, but I've had some questions about whether or not you and I have been in the same room recording our podcast together. Part of it's because of this pristine audio that we're getting. But I don't know if our listeners realize that I don't think I'd seen you in person since March. And in fact, I haven't seen anyone from Crown in person since March. So a highlight for me was seeing you guys last night. You guys came over and were able to hang out for a little while, which was refreshing. And it's always, I think, refreshing also to hang out outside of work. So, because, you know, we didn't know each other prior to working together at Crown, but I think, you know, we've developed a friendship that, you know, means we want to hang out outside of Crown too. So it nice to be able to do that, even though, you know, we don't live super close to each other, but it was nice that you guys were able to make it out and we were able to hang out last night.
So. Yeah. Well, that was going to be my highlight too. But I mean, I was thinking about this. It's been, it was literally more than 3 months that we were not actually in the same place, right?
Yeah.
Like that's a long time. Like that's longer than summer. And over summer, we usually get together a couple of times to talk through some course things or whatever, you know, if not to hang out. So it's like, yeah, it's just weird thinking about those kinds of interruptions. And also we went out to visit my, my in-laws, and it was good to get out. I've really enjoyed this last month being, or last 3 months being in the house. Like I've actually come to appreciate our house, but it was really nice to get out. They live out in the sand hills in Nebraska, and just to have a change of scenery was good.
So was there a big group of people there, or is it just your family and your in-laws?
Yeah. So Jenny's, the whole rest of Jenny's family lives out in that area. She has three siblings. So there are four families plus her parents. So,
oh, but you weren't all staying at the place. So they were from their house.
No. Yeah. And that was another nice thing is we actually had a whole house to ourselves. So
nice.
That was nice
for you.
I think it's along these same lines that I have enjoyed the opportunity to see some more people. We had some friends over, you know, we saw you guys, family, but there's this nagging feeling of like, am I putting somebody else at risk of being sick? Am I going to get sick? You know, and it takes away some of, I don't want to say it takes away any of the joy of being with people. I don't think it does, but it adds this layer that's really unpleasant of, you know, gosh, I hope there aren't unintended consequences, you know, and we're trying to be careful, you know, I mean, like when we're hanging out with you guys, we're outside, you know, things like that. But yeah, I think it's really, really hard to know because clearly the disease hasn't gone away, right? You look at the numbers and it's still very much around. Yeah, and trying to figure out how to function as, and not necessarily like normal, but I don't know. Anyway, so I think that's been probably a little late for me is just this kind of nagging concern about all that.
And then the wondering whether or not it will go away anytime soon. Right. Is it, how long is this going to be registered on our brains? The necessity of keeping some social distance as well as looking out for other folks when we're hanging out. It's like we never really had to think about that before because if you had the flu or something, you know, you just wouldn't go to somebody's house. But now knowing that there are people who are asymptomatic and carrying that, it makes it just a whole different game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. How about for you? What's a low light been?
Well, you know, in some ways I hesitate to even mention this because of my own reactions against people on Facebook who have used the George Floyd Memorial site as a way to kind of, I don't know, my impressions is that sometimes it's a little show-offy.
Oh,
you know. Look at me. I was here.
That virtue thing, virtue signaling thing we were talking about before.
Exactly. Yeah. So I hesitate to mention this, but I think I should because it's just it's something that's on my mind. But we had a chance, Jill and I, to go just cruising around the city in Minneapolis to check out, you know, what it looks like now. Cause, you know, we were out of town when everything happened and we were able to go to the spot where the memorial is for George Floyd. And I mean, to call it a low light isn't because it wasn't a powerful experience. You know, they've got a location set up down there at a little park where there are makeshift graves. I think they're made out of like cardboard, but it lists a lot of the folks who've been killed by police, Black folks who've been killed by police, you know, in recent years. And that's just a sobering experience to see visually.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen any of those. I know you've seen some of those pictures of the names too, that are just etched on the pavement too, of folks, you know, recently who have been killed by the police. And it's, there's something moving visually to see it that way. And I don't want to take away from the fact that it's like, again, the reason I think I hesitate to even talk about it is if it's like, oh, look at me, I'm a white person, and now I'm woke, and I'm becoming, you know, I'm realizing how significant and how bad these things have been. It, what bothers me about that, again, is just that this isn't anything that's new. I mean, this has been happening for a while. On the other hand, there is something about being at the site and seeing how many people are down there and seeing the reactions that the public have had that is a bit of a wake-up call in ways that I hadn't seen before. And, you know, I've talked to you about this before, but I think they should find a way to permanently memorialize it. You know, I had a chance some years ago to go down to the go down to Dallas and see the spot, you know, where Kennedy was assassinated. And, you know, they've got a museum there and everything. Now, he was president of the United States, and it was a pretty major moment, you know, in American history. Right. But there's this almost a sense of like the need to remember, right? And I feel the same way with this, which maybe leads to the insight in some ways, is the kind of danger that we run. You know, we've talked about this before on the podcast, but the danger that we run of letting a couple of weeks pass or a month pass or however long since George Floyd was killed and then just going on with life. I think if society, if we really want to take seriously the sort of insights that we're, that we've been gaining the last several weeks, we probably need to do more to etch that into our memory to ensure that we don't forget and that we stay committed to the cause of racial justice and equality. And so I think something like that would be beneficial. Yeah. I know you haven't had a chance to get down there yet, but you've seen some of the pictures, right?
Yeah. I think that that fits for me, and an insight that something I've been thinking through anyway, is how well Germany has done at remembering, right? I mean,
yeah, it's a really interesting point.
And it's painful, right? To go to a concentration camp or to walk down the street and have the little brass plates in the ground saying that, you know, such and such family was removed from this house, you know, as part of the Holocaust. The, you know, and it's all over. I mean, I'm just thinking of Berlin, but it's all over the place. There are ways to remember.
Yeah.
And the memories are not good memories, right? There are also, of course, in the same place, memories of good things, but there are all of these unpleasant things. But this really intense commitment to remembering, and it comes with a cost too, you know, but I think the cost of not remembering is very, very high. And I guess that connects in a way with our guest today. It'll be good to hear what she has to say. But I think there's just this really, I don't know, Miroslav Volf has that book, Remembering Rightly in a Violent World. And I think his wrestling with that idea of what does it mean to remember rightly and to remember through who Jesus is something that is probably worth pushing into more.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, there's been memorials set up, you know, like at the Emmett Till spot as a Tallahatchie, right? And I know that's even been desecrated many times, like shooting bullets at it. So they had to make a new sign. I know that there's a memorial spot at Wounded Knee in South Dakota. And both of those memorials, I think, represent the kind of memorial we're talking about, something that would be a very painful memory and a part of American history and of people who've gone through some rough things. But the necessity for those sites, I think, are important.
Well, our guest is here. We'll be back in a moment with Christian Curtis. So I'm glad to have with us today Christian Curtis, who was at Crown when I started working there, but we didn't ever have class together. Christian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I am an enrolled member of the Fort Peck tribe. I grew up in Poplar, Montana, and basically lived here my whole life with the exception of when I attended Crown. I graduated in 2015 with my bachelor's in Christian studies as well as nursing. And I feel like Crownies are going to laugh, but I did meet my husband. And yes, it was within like the first month of attending Crown. And we have been together ever since. Got married shortly after graduation and moved back home, and we're in a really great part of our life. We have two crazy boys, James, who's 3, and Eli, who's 1. And after moving back, I began working for the tribes, and I work for an organization called HPDP, and I work in a school-based health clinic where we provide health services on all the schools, pretty much all the schools on the reservation, with medical, dental, nutrition, chiropractic, and mental health services. And so, yeah, that is what I'm doing currently, and a little summary of who I am.
So as we were, I mean, we started talking maybe a month ago or so about the possibility of you joining us. And of course, there's been a lot that's changed. I don't even know if changed is the right word. I think we're more aware as a society of tensions, you know, in the last month. But when we started talking about you coming on, one of the things that Justin and I had noticed is that some of the ways that COVID was has been impacting Native American populations has been, in some cases, really terrible. And we haven't heard a whole lot about that. And so we wanted to ask you about that, what you've heard about how Native peoples are being affected by COVID.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of ways to answer that question. And first, how I want to start out is, you know, I do want to point out that I'm talking about, you know, my perspective today, mm-hmm. And know that there are differences in how COVID is affecting other tribal communities. So I'll go in and talk about, you know, my tribe specifically, and then I'll branch out from there and talk about, you know, other stories that I've heard with other tribes. But when we first heard about COVID at the beginning of the year, you know, one of the things that we kept hearing time and time again is who was at the highest risk, and elders, you know, the elder population was at highest risk. And, you know, for us culturally, elders are highly valued because they hold our teachings, they hold our knowledge, you know, of our language and our culture. And so I feel as a tribe, we, you know, did everything we could to protect them. There are a lot of great programs that continued feeding programs. There's one program that put signs on elders' doors to identify that elders were in the home. Our program, we put together elder kits that had, you know, masks, gloves, cleaning supplies, and then we continued to make calls throughout the time at home. But another thing that, you know, we heard is that the other high-risk population are those with other conditions such as asthma, diabetes, you know, heart conditions. And that's something that Native Americans also have a high rate of. And so looking at that, you know, it was concerning for us, and how do we best protect our people? But looking at Fort Peck specifically, geographically, we are in an isolated area where, aside from COVID, we already have a hard time, you know, access to care is limited. You know, we're kind of in a food desert, I guess, as you can say. Mm-hmm. Recruiting providers and keeping providers has always been difficult. You know, when we talk about access to care, for some care that people need, they have to travel 5 hours. And so that's already difficult. And with COVID, one thing that, you know, came up and, you know, all around the U.S. and all the world, around the world, is that we know that PPE there was a shortage of PPE.
That's the personal protective equipment?
Yes. Yep. Personal protective equipment. So gloves, masks, gowns, things like that. And our supplier basically said, you know, they have to divert to the larger areas, which, to a point, you understand. But at the same time, in rural areas, there's still people that are still being affected, and we still need those supplies. So already, it presented, there's so many barriers to this, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, aside from COVID. You know, now with COVID, we have to think about how to best go about, you know, the last few months and the next year.
You know, one thing Steve and I mentioned before, talked about actually in a previous podcast episode, is that there's been, you know, a reaction, I think, from a lot of folks against wearing masks, as if it's like an infringement upon a person's rights. Have you noticed any of those kinds of reactions happening in Fort Peck, or do you feel like it's been pretty widely accepted that people haven't been resistant to wearing masks and even accommodating in light of, you know, the necessity to care for the elderly and for folks with pre-existing conditions?
Yeah. So I think when we, you know, knew that there was a shortage and that we had a hard time getting masks, a lot of people were able to make masks. And how people responded was, you know, there was so much in the beginning, you know, things were changing daily of what we knew about the virus. But when you look at it, I'm not going to hurt anybody, you know, by wearing a mask, but I may pose a threat if I don't. You know, and so until we know more information, it's better for us too. And so a lot of people did wear a mask, and we did have a small, you know, we're fortunate in that we had a small positive cases And it was basically in one area, and they did a great job in containing it and not a community spread. But a lot of people, you know, during that time adhered to the guidelines of staying home. And when they went out, they took all the precautions that they needed to. But yeah, I say that a lot of people took it seriously here. That was good.
So you didn't really see as many of those reactions of people kind of internally revolting against the idea.
not too many here. Not where I'm live, but on my Facebook, I did see that.
As you mentioned the issue with the PPE, it sounds like there is, I guess it's interesting that there's these ethical choices being made, right? Of who gets the equipment, who doesn't. And I feel like that process is pretty invisible to most of us. And when it affects people who are already marginalized somehow, that the potential, I don't know, miscarriage of justice in terms of caring for the humanity of others could go kind of unnoticed. Has that been part of that experience?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, you know, and I'll talk more about this later on, is, you know, looking at other communities, you know, like Navajo Nation. I know of a pastor who has gone down there, and he actually just recently returned from there. And one of the things that he said is that a lot of the supplies that they're getting, like, are they getting aid? Yes, but it's also going to the bigger areas, so that people in the outlying communities haven't received anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the things that he said that one of the members had said, which is pretty concerning, is, you know, they said, I feel like they've forgotten about us. Mm. You know, do we matter? And it's hard to explain all those, you know, all those barriers, again, aside from COVID. So when COVID, you know, presented, and yeah, it's made it difficult overall.
And that was the largest reservation in the country, isn't it?
Yeah,
Navajo. So yeah, so you're saying that even within the reservation of Navajo, that the major cities are, and major there, of course, is relative. We're not talking like, you know, a couple million people, but the bigger cities in Navajo were receiving far more of the care than people who are living in the smaller areas. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And we actually have a member from Navajo who came and did a mission trip at our church 2 years ago. And our pastor has been in contact with him, you know, since the beginning of the year. He reached out to us and said, you know, he took on 100 families that live in these outside areas. And one of the biggest things that he said is, we need food and water, but mainly water. And so sometimes you forget that the basic needs still aren't being met, and there's still a need for those supplies in those areas.
So one of the things you mentioned already is how the Native experience is not one, right? It's not monolithic. And so the Native experiences of COVID are not one. What are you hearing about different types of Native experiences? You mentioned a little bit with the Navajo, but what else are you hearing?
Yeah, so I'm very, you know, fortunate when all of this happened to be a part of a group that, you know, weekly or every other week, different tribes come together and they talk about, or they give presentations on what has worked in their tribes and what, you know, things that have worked well and things that they wish would have worked differently, or barriers that they had, you know. And so that has been really good insight, and that is the collaborative effort, and in that, yes, tribes are different, but we also have some of the same issues. And so that we're able to kind of lean on each other during this time. And healthcare wise, a lot of tribes, because there's a shortage of, you know, PPE and equipment that we need, a lot of them are moving to a telehealth platform, which is basically, in a way, kind of what we're doing now through Zoom. It's a video conferencing where, you know, if there's a concern of, you know, how COVID is going to affect somebody, but we can give them the tools and the equipment to still seek care and still seek the medical care that they need. And so that a lot of tribes are working and implementing that, which has been great.
Are there any issues with internet access as far as telehealth?
Yeah. So for our tribe specifically, one of the internet carriers has made hotspots throughout the communities, which has been really nice. And our tribe has allowed us to buy equipment to where we can also provide a hotspot if they need to make a connection, yeah, which has been great.
That is great.
Yeah. For folks who maybe aren't super knowledgeable of tribal governance, in what ways are In what ways is Fort Peck under the restrictions of the decisions made by the state of Montana? And in what ways does the tribe make their own decisions in terms of stay-at-home orders and things like that?
Yeah, so our tribe specifically, they were able to make, you know, the state of Montana released regulations, but our tribe was also able to, you know, take those regulations and, you know, adhere to those or even make them stricter. You know, so we, the tribal government has sent everybody, most of the employees home in the middle of March. And the essential employees were still working and delivering services, but there is a very limited number of people. And the reason for that is they, again, tribes know what their people face. And so what they implement, you know, whether it's the closing of roads or sending people home from work and things like that, they're doing what they can to protect their people because they know, again, the barriers that exist within those communities. Again, we've had a small number of cases, which we've been thankful for, but in a few weeks, we're going to open up pretty much at 100%. And a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of mixed feelings of, yeah, of what you feel about it is, you're kind of, you know, in one sense, you're excited because you kind of want to get back into that normal routine again. But in another way, you don't know what the future holds either. And so we still want to practice, you know, guidelines, but we're also trying to prepare for this next year.
Have the churches then closed as well on the reservation?
They were for about a month or a month and a half, and they started opening. Our church specifically got rid of pews, and they have chairs. And so they separated the chairs throughout the church to give that distance between families that come in. And one cool thing that I'm seeing with the churches is that they live streamed their services. And our pastor said one time, like, he had so many views, like, it was nice, you know, that, yeah, it was nice that other people were listening, you know, that might not have been physically at the church. And so it was a good way for us to reach out to continue that outreach.
Mm. What do you wish the non-Native people understood about the experience on the reservations, whether that's COVID or in general?
Yeah. So this question, you know, I kind of wrestled with how to answer it the best way. And a few days ago, you know, I was listening to another podcast, and it was from Robbie Zacharias and his team. And one of the things that they talked about, and hopefully you get the connection that I'm trying to make here, but this was specifically speaking to apologetics, and he was talking about how to answer questions. And he said, sometimes Christians get so caught up in how to answer the question that they forget the individual that's asking the question. You know, and when we talked about COVID, you know, at the beginning of the year, I reached out to a lot of people and some that weren't, you know, didn't live on the reservation, and just kind of expressed my concerns. And I had a lot of great conversations, but there were some conversations where I almost felt defeated in the end, you know, that my concerns weren't being validated, you know, that I was told that, you know, I'm overthinking this, like, don't worry about it, all these things. You know, and as I think about that, like, I know my experience and I, you know, I know the barriers here. And so it was kind of difficult, you know, at the end of the conversation, I was like, you know, I questioned my concerns. But at the end of the day, I know my story and I know where I live better than anyone. And I feel like right now, you know, Christians have such a great opportunity right now to speak. But let me back up. They have such a great opportunity to help. And it's not always with their words. And sometimes it's listening and validating the person that's talking to you, whether or not you agree with their views or not, you know. And I think that that's just an important point to make, and that it's so important to listen and not think about your response, you know, and what you want to say and what you want to contribute, because sometimes the answer and the truth to that answer is in that conversation itself and listening to that person. And so I think that would be what I would want to encourage for sure. So
it seems like part of, we were talking before you joined us about the issue of remembering and, you know, questions. Justin was mentioning the George Floyd Memorial here in Minneapolis, and, you know, questions of whether that'll be preserved long term. And I wonder if part of where we have difficulty listening as a society to Native peoples is partly wrapped up with that question of remembering. As we were getting ready, I was looking at, there's this website where you can look at what Native lands you are located on, right? You can look up your address. And I, I was looking at it and I was like, I honestly don't know how to pronounce the names of the peoples that this was their land, right? And obviously the conceptualization of, you know, land ownership and all that's different, right? But that this was land that was part of these people's lived experience. And I don't even know how to say their names, that we have such a lack of remembering. And if I don't remember the people, then I don't even know to listen.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, I had a chance in the summers of 2001, 2002 to spend some time on the Pyramid Lake Paiute Reservation in Nevada. And one thing that really struck me about their tribe was that they had this very pointed origins story that was told and retold within their tribal communities as to where their people came from. Mm-hmm. And it was related to a specific location actually on the reservation that they kind of see as memorialized as the mother that kind of founded their tribal community. What was interesting to me about it was, you know, they had things in their cultural center that referenced this, and they had, I'm sure you couldn't be a part of that tribe and not know that story. So I felt like there are some things in place for the idea of memory within their tribal community that I hadn't experienced within my own cultural experience. Do you feel like that's true of other tribes? And do you feel like that was your experience in terms of that concept of how tribal communities remember their history and remember their experiences? That there are just things that are sort of etched into their narratives in ways that maybe aren't always experienced in other communities outside of tribal communities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think our culture is, you know, is an important part of who we are, and our traditions are an important part of who we are. And it's, you know, there's always that push to know that, you know, to know where you come from. You know, we kind of always say that it's important to know where you come from, you know, to know where you're going. You know, and I, again, like our elders, they're our teachers, and they're the ones that, you know, tell us about, you know, how it was back then, you know, things that their family had brought down to them. And so it's important for us to hear those and respect those, because we don't want to lose, you know, any part of our culture that makes us who we are. You know, and a lot of things is we are always trying to get back to like who we say we are as Native people. And yeah, our culture and our stories are a big part of that.
If somebody is listening and they say, well, I would like to learn to listen, but they aren't living life with Native people, what does that look like? What would it look like to learn to listen or to practice listening?
You know, I think that there are a lot of resources, you know, books and sometimes podcasts, YouTube series of things that people can watch and learn and see, you know, how the communication and how people communicate. And then when they, you know, are, you know, near a reservation or in a reservation and talking with Native people, you know, that's your opportunity to listen to what they have to say. And so, yeah, I just encourage that. Because, yeah, one of the things that I've noticed, like, growing up is sometimes you have people that come in and you know that they really want to listen and listen to your culture. But then sometimes, and unknowingly, people come in and say, you know, are you supposed to do that? Should you do that? Like, all mm-hmm. these things. And sometimes it's just good just to watch and observe first before, you know, you give your two cents, I guess.
I was with, when I was working at the University of Nebraska at Kearney, there was a group of graduate counseling students that went up to Pine Ridge Reservation. And what was fascinating to me is there's often, I don't know, this desire to do something, right? And I remember somebody was asking the question of one of the hosts, you know, what can we do, right? And I think the frameworks that are in our minds the experiences in our minds are things like, you know, can I paint something or can I build something, you know, that kind of thing. And what the host said to us was, what you can do for us is you can come, you can be present with us, hear our stories, and then go and tell our stories. And what was so interesting about that is it, I think in some ways it's much less satisfying, you know, in the short run. You know, if I can go and paint something, then I've accomplished something, right? Like, I've painted a wall and I can see that I've painted the wall. Being entrusted with somebody else's story is this huge responsibility. And it seems like there's some sense in which if we're going to listen well, there's we encounter the humanity of somebody else and become responsible for that in a way that we may find ourselves resisting because we may not actually want to be responsible for that. Does that connect at all to?
Yeah. And I think when you really take the time to listen to somebody and their stories, you get a different perspective. You know, you get their perspective. And so hopefully that opens, you know, that individual's eyes of maybe that experience of, you know, maybe the elder that's telling him or the community member from that reservation. And I think, you know, as I said before, storytelling is an important part of who we are, you know, telling our stories. And so for somebody to listen to that, you know, and take it and be able to talk on it in a good way is a good thing. So.
We've been reflecting the last few weeks on the George Floyd killing and as well as all the events that have kind of followed that, you know, subsequently. What's been the reaction at Fort Peck just to all the events that have happened?
Yeah. So, you know, with everything that's going on, it's heartbreaking, you know, what happened to that young man. And I feel like a lot of people are understanding kind of the movement of what people are saying, you know, of they want their voices heard because they feel like it hasn't been heard, you know, and I feel like Natives feel that as well. And so they're, you know, coming together to try to bring more awareness and have those hard talks with people who think that there isn't, you know, in some ways, and racism throughout, you know, and it's a hard topic to talk about, but I think it's an important topic to talk about because we need to be aware. Because again, we haven't walked in somebody else's shoes; we don't know the things that they've faced, and so yeah, it's so important for us to look at ourselves and think, how can we help, you know, in this situation? And it starts in our hearts; it starts in our homes. You know, it's bringing awareness to things that people face. And so, yeah, I've seen a lot of, I guess you could say, solidarity with, you know, our other communities.
Part of my experience, I think, growing up in the public schools that I went to, were that we kind of rushed over certain aspects of history and American history that were very painful. And then when I was in seminary, I ended up reading a book called Missionary Conquest by George Tinker. And I think the subheading is something along the lines of like cultural genocide of Native Americans. And I think the idea was he traced several missionaries who did missionary movements to Native American peoples, and he traced how they contributed to the cultural genocide of those tribes. Which was the idea of, you know, how did you put it? Kill the Indian, save the man. Mm-hmm. And so I'd be interested to know, like, your experience in your public education growing up, were those stories and those ideas highlighted far more? Because I didn't remember getting that much in my experience in public schools as a kid.
Yeah, thankfully, you know, I think being on a reservation, they do talk about more of our history more. But one of the things that was really interesting, and this came from one of my history teachers in high school, was he said, you know, we have all of these outlines or, you know, regulations that we have to teach, but there's so much more to teach about Native American culture, mm-hmm. but we also have the pressure to try to meet all of these standards. Mm-hmm. And so really he showed us, like, in our history book, it was just briefly talked about, but we know that there was more to that story. And mm-hmm. I think it's really important, you know, as Americans to know our history, the good and the bad. You know, so that we prevent things like that from happening, but we also validate the people that are still hurting from those things. You know, you talk about boarding schools, and I think that's affected me more being a mom. Like, I couldn't imagine having my kids taken from me, you know, not knowing where they are, not knowing how they are. And then when they're brought back to me, the only language that we knew, I can't communicate with them anymore.
And somehow I feel like the version of that story that's presented to white folks, if we're aware of it, mm-hmm. is very sanitized. And,
yes.
it's a horrible story. Mm-hmm. But it's something that we should not only remember, but remember rightly.
Yes.
And I to mourn that is part of our story.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's important to talk about those things. And so, yes, I wish history books were written a little differently, and, you know, in regards to our U.S. history.
I've got a almost 4 year old and a fairly newborn here, about 3 months old. So a little bit different than your kids are, is it four?
Three and one. Mm-hmm.
3 and 1. Okay. Yeah. So not super far off. How has being a mom, brought perspective in terms of, what you might do to have your kids aware of their own cultural heritage and experiences?
Yeah. So, I mean, anybody that knows me knows I'm pretty light skinned. And so my kids are blonde hair, blue eyes, but we always tell them that, you know, you're Indian, you are native, you know, and I want them to embrace that and learn that. And I want them, you know, my husband and I are trying to teach them my language. We want them to dance, you know, with their grandpa, my dad, you know, at powwows. And so, yeah, we want them to know their culture, know where they come from and be proud of who they are, you know, and speak to Native history if they have the opportunity to.
What would you call or invite Jesus followers to pray for, to think about, to do regarding Native peoples at this time?
Yeah, so one of the things that my grandma always said is that more things are brought about by prayer than we even realize. And so I think praying, you know, that we know how to deal with the situation, you know, that are presented before us, that we get the resources that we need, but more importantly, that our voices are heard, you know, and I think that that's a really important piece. And as far as, you know, how they can help, kind of going back to the family friend, Bruce, and what he's done at Navajo and what he said is, you know, it's really important to, if we're going to help, to identify the people that know those communities and know where the greatest need is being met. You know, sometimes we think, not saying that, you know, bigger corporations or bigger organizations that we donate to don't do good, but sometimes we, you know, as we kind of discussed it before, like painting that wall, you're like, okay, I did it, I'm good. But there's other ways that you can help. And usually the people in those areas know what needs to be, you know, the churches know what resources need to be made. One thing I want to say that's really cool that one of the organizations have done is they built chicken coops and provided chickens for the family. And so that's something that's more sustainable in the long run. And so that was really neat to hear. So.
Well, this has been delightful.
So good talking with you. Really nice to meet you.
Yes, it was good meeting.
Well, thanks. Thanks again.
Have a good day.
You too.
Yeah.
Bye.
So I thought we had a really interesting conversation today with Christian. What are some of your thoughts on our discussion?
I mean, the thing of listening, right, being so important, which connects in some ways to what we're seeing with the whole movement around George Floyd's death, right, as well as others, right? But I think this thought of how she mentioned that there's this problem with people asking questions or interacting, not to listen, right? And I think we see that in the whole Black Lives Matter thing, the way that people are responding is very often with this question of how do I justify myself or how do I shut down your uncomfortable perspective? Why do you think we're so resistant to listening?
I think you're hinting at some of it. Maybe there's just a sense of defensiveness. Like people don't want to feel like they're contributing to the horrors of society. And when it's sort of not always extremely direct, I think there can be this sense of like a feeling of needing to defend oneself or something. Also, a lot of us, I think, live in almost monocultural communities, right? Where we may not actually only have one culture among us, but for all practical purposes, we pretty much maybe live in those spaces, mm-hmm. right? With friendships and with communities and all that, which can sometimes mean that it's harder to hear voices coming from folks who have different experiences than us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you're asking a huge question here. I'm not sure. You know, I can only speculate, right? And you're the interculturalist, so you should have the answer, not me, right? or we could take this the New Testament route and we could say, well, theologically speaking, maybe there's something about who we are as human beings that are just simply resistant sometimes to hearing other perspectives and that get into defensive mode. Because there's this sense of wrongness in us that tries to justify things that are not justifiable. So there you go. There's my answer as a New Testament person, right? Is that maybe it's part of the human condition of our incapability of hearing others. There could be this sort of sense of self-centeredness in us at times that comes out in these moments.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
So here's what I'm wondering about. If we, and maybe I'm risking theologizing this inappropriately, I don't know, but what I'm wondering about is there a sense in which we, to the extent that we have difficulty listening to voices that are not like ours, and whether those are Christian voices or not Christian voices, but I wonder, is there also then a sense in which we maybe have difficulty listening to the voice of God?
I mean, now you're getting into a really complicated question that we won't have time, I think, to address, you know, in its entirety here. The concept of, I think, listening to the voice of God can be a frightening phrase, I think, for some people.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because we can turn God into anything we want God to be. And we can justify our own perspectives sometimes, right?
We can pretend like we're turning God into anything we want God to be, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I think a danger is, you know, I think about the revulsion in our society, and rightly so in some ways, the minute you hear somebody say, God told me blank, right? And I think that, you know, it's interesting because a lot of Christians, I think, would just counteract that by saying, well, come on, God exists and you know, if God were to speak.
And really to answer the wrong question, right?
To answer the wrong question, because I think the revulsion against some of that language is completely justified. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that usually it's used to talk about things that, to self-justify oneself.
And particularly when it's used by people in power, it's been used to harm others, right?
For sure. But theologically speaking, you know, I think back to like Karl Barth, the theologian, Swiss theologian, you know, who had such a huge impact on theology in the 20th century, in this concept of God being wholly other, meaning that God is so distinctly God is so distinctly different in some ways from human beings that any chance that we take to try to make God out to be like us is problematic. On the other hand, theologically speaking, right, if we read Genesis and we hear about human beings being created in God's image, there has to be some sense of likeness, right?
And there's this, well, just the sense in which God extended God's self toward us through Christ, right?
Sure.
But that's.
And but this idea you're getting at then, though, the idea of an incapacity for listening to other people could be in some ways a reflection of our incapacity to hear God, I think is true to the extent that God is other than us, right? Like God isn't, we try sometimes theologically as humans to make God out to be the God we want, the God who's like us. So in some ways, I think what you're getting at is very pertinent, is that in some ways, if God is, and God is irrespective of what we want to make God out to be, our incapacity for hearing others could also be a reflection of that in some ways, right? Of not willing to hear a being that's other than us.
Yeah, I mean, we see indications of that. We see this in 1 John, right? How can you love God? But how can you love God whom you've not seen if you can't love your brother whom you have seen, right? So we see this represented within the Christian faith, right? But I think there is even this broader sense. But even if it's just within the Christian faith, right? There are so many different ways of being human and being Christian, right? Mm-hmm. There's plenty of opportunity to listen, but I think there is also something, I mean, we see it with Paul, right? In Acts, being able to interact with people with a reasoning structure that's different than his own, right? With a faith system that's different than his own. And he's listened, and maybe this gets back to something that we talked about a few weeks ago, you know, how do you enter into other people's worlds, you know, into their truth universe, into their experience of what it means to, yeah, to be human while also maintaining some consistency. But anyway, I feel like maybe I've gotten off in the weeds here, but I think this question of listening, that there's a spiritual discipline perhaps of listening, that there is something good about listening. And I think where we're maybe scared of listening, to instead of take that, I think sometimes we take that fear of what it's going to reveal about me, of what it's going to reveal about even how strong is my faith, right? I'm afraid to listen to somebody because maybe they're going to challenge my faith. Like, what if we took that fear and instead of using that to be defensive against somebody, to protect ourselves, what if we took that fear and took it to God and said, this person said something and it scared me. How would you respond to them? And that's where maybe I'm suggesting that it could be I'm asking, could it be a form of spiritual discipline to listen? Is that, I don't know.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. And I wonder, when we make God out to be the boss and the ruler, sometimes I think our capacity to listen is because we inherently sometimes value listening to people who are leaders and people who are authorities. And so when we're used to listening to people who are leaders and authorities, it can cause us to kind of transfer that over to our concept of God and say, well, God's a ruler and authority, so yeah, let's listen to God. But when we reverse it and we think of folks who are not rulers and authorities, but people who have been oppressed, people who've been outcast, people who've been overlooked by society, if we only have this paradigm that listening matters for those in authority, it can cause us, I think, to shut off to those folks. Mm-hmm. But ironically, theologically speaking, we have every reason to also understand God not only as authority or as the big boss, but God as the oppressed and God as the overlooked and God as the outcast and of Jesus on the cross, right? And this is in some ways James Cone's idea, I think, if I'm doing it any service, of the cross and the lynching tree, mm-hmm. of the necessity to understand Jesus from the vantage point of Black folks who've been oppressed and lynched, mm-hmm. right? And so in some ways, I think there's this power, what it says about our listening capacities, if our listening capacity is only there for those who are in authority, it may say a lot about our view of God, mm-hmm. right? Of God as the authority. But when we refuse to hear those who have been discarded by society, or who have been given less voice, and I'm not sure if we understand that's actually also in some ways a rejection of Jesus, yeah. as a oppressed person. Right. And I'm speaking from within Christian communities, right? I'm talking about Christians who claim to follow in the ways of Jesus, but who only make God out to be the big boss authority, and then who are refusing to see Jesus from the vantage point of the oppressed.
So I saw something that just really was troubling the other day. It was this video of this couple that was protesting a Confederate memorial, and this guy walks up to them and they have this confrontation. He's very upset that they're protesting. And at some point, the lady asks, and of course, you know, like any video, you're only getting one limited perspective. You know, who knows what else was happening, but in the video, what you see is the lady asking, so sir, what would make you feel better? And he says, well, if you all went to hell. And she says, well, that's not going to happen. And as he's walking away, they talk a little bit longer, but as he's walking away, she says, Jesus loves you, right? Which indicates that probably she perceives herself as being part of the family, right? Part of the yeah. He turns around and he says, yes, he does, but he sure hates people like you, or he sure hates you, really? Something like that. Yeah. And I just, I'm like, how have we gotten so far? And here's the thing. I think it's very easy to look at that guy and be like, oh man, he's missed it. Right. But like, if we're honest, I think there's a lot of that in all of us, that Jesus is on my side and he's not on your side.
Yeah.
And I think this is where Barth was so important, right? And calling some of that out in reflecting on the war. And of course, Barth had all sorts of problems too, right? Which we now know about.
Sure.
But this observation, when we claim that God is on our side, as the big boss.
We need some brutal conclusions. I mean, Barth's whole thing, historically speaking, was he lived through the horrors of World War I, and he saw both sides of the war claiming God was on their side. And he's like, what does this say about our view of God? And so for Barth wanted to say, you can't do that. God isn't who you want God to be. In other words, God isn't the champion of your cause. And he was disturbed by how both sides did that. Mm-hmm. And so I think theologically speaking, it makes total sense, the move that he was making, but it can feel very, the minute that we start to think, well, maybe God isn't the champion of my cause, can be very displacing for us. Mm-hmm.
And that's part of where I think listening is so important. And here's part of what I love about the contextualization class. This is something I've been thinking about for a while. I had started writing a book and then just was never really able to finish it, but maybe it'll come back. But I think in 2014, I was writing about this and this observation that there's this opportunity to learn. There's an opportunity for the church globally to learn from the minority church within the US and to learn from the global church. And that when we disaggregate the experience of what it means to be a follower of Christ from the experience of what it means to be culturally dominant, mm-hmm. that what emerges is something really beautiful and powerful, something that actually has an internal cohesion that defies expectations, because, you know, you start to see all of these radically different experiences. You start to see all these radically different experiences and think, well, how can this hold together? But it holds together so much more than something which relies on hegemony to, you know, to keep itself going. Thank you for joining us for Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Christian said that anyone who wants to learn more about how to connect is welcome to email her, so we've put a link in the show notes so you can get in touch. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.